Welcome, fellow explorers. My name is Christian Alexanderson, and this is Hemlocks to Hellbenders, a podcast highlighting Pennsylvania's parks, forests, and great outdoors. I'm often plagued by a flawed understanding of the outdoors. I believe that the outdoors is World's End, or Cook Forest, or Ricketts Glen. It's a forested landscape with no cell phone signal, no interstates, and nowhere near a city. But that's not right. There's natural beauty all over the Commonwealth, including in and around Pennsylvania's biggest city, Philadelphia. That was my biggest takeaway from reading the book Wild Philly. The book shines a much-needed light on the amazing nature you can see, hear, and touch in the Philadelphia area. It highlights and celebrates the natural splendor that can be found all around the city of brotherly love. Wild Philly discusses the history of the region, provides information on the plants, trees, and animals that can be found, and recommends where you can explore the great outdoors in the greater Philadelphia area. I'm excited to welcome Mike Weilbacher to the podcast. Mike is the author of Wild Philly and the former longtime executive director of the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education. Mike, thanks for joining the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your book, Wild Philly. How did it come to be?
So it's published by Timber Press, and they've been doing now a whole series of books on nature in large cities. So Wild LA was their first one. And then I was thrilled. They reached out to me and asked me if I would consider writing a Wild Philly version of the book. And I was like waiting for this email my whole life. So yes, I would love to. But they since come out with New Orleans and Miami. There's a Wild Dallas. So they're doing this versions of this across the country. And the Wild Philly fits into their model of how the book is laid out.
And why did they come for you to write it?
Yeah, so I've been doing environmental education in the Philly area for 40 years now, oh my word. And for many of those years, I've been a columnist for local newspapers. So I guess in Googling nature in Philly, they got to a lot of my columns. So I wrote for two different newspapers over 25 years. So I got really lucky. So happily, I'm all over the web.
How did you define the area covered in this book? What do you mean by Philly?
I thought about that a lot. And I knew, you know, if you want to explore nature in Philadelphia, it's not just the city itself. So what I decided to do was two things. One is when somebody asks you if you're from Philly, people who live in the near counties typically will say yes. Probably like Lancaster County, they might say no, or they wouldn't identify as Philly. So it's kind of the counties that are near the city. So the five counties, including Philadelphia. And then I also kind of went with what TV stations might do in Philadelphia News. So the three counties on the Jersey side that hug the Delaware River. So it's the eight counties with Philly right in the middle of that.
What do you love most about the region you wrote about?
So I'm a transplant. I'm a New Yorker by birth, but like I said, I've been here 40 years now. So this is home. So many things. I love that we've got the Piedmont and the great forests on the western side of the Wild Philly area, and then the coastal plain and more flat on the Jersey side especially. So that gives you some great variety. I love our forests. We have great forests. I love the geology. Like when you go for a walk in the Wissahickon, you just want to know, why are those rocks there? what happened? I love that we're the northernmost place for some southern species and the southernmost place for some northern species. So being in the mid-Atlantic, we get kind of that nice bump of the two. So there's just a lot of wonderful things that I love about it.
Wild Philly is separated into three sections. The first deals with the region's history, threats to nature, and more. The second covers species, and third, field trips. What was your process like for writing those sections? How long did it take you to write?
This was a long process. So I used the Wild LA model with so there's 10 introductory chapters, and then the 101 species you ought to know if you live in the Philly area. And then there's the 25 walks, and I wanted to do some extra credit walks too. So if you live in Philly, in the Philly area, and you love nature, you got to go to Hawk Mountain in the fall to see the migrating hawks. You got to go to the Pine Barrens and explore. So there's extra things you kind of have to do, and people who love nature in Philly do. So I used the Wild LA and the other wild cities model of how to lay the book out. Started doing a lot of reading, started collecting my own books. And then I assembled a team of other naturalists from the area who would help me. I needed backup. So, you know, there's thousands of species to choose from. So which ones do we choose? If we're going to get down to 101, you're going to leave some good ones out. And then, boy, if you're going to do 25 walks, there's some friends that of mine who work at other sites who are going to be not happy that their site wasn't included. So that's really hard. So I know I need a backup on that. The eight naturalists and myself worked on the 101 species and the field trips. And then I did a lot of reading to do the intro chapters. And relying on people too. So I had, especially for the geology section, which is not my native language at all, I had two readers who weighed in on the final product. And then on the Lenape section, I actually had an active member of the Lenape Nation read it for me as backup as well. This happily came just before the pandemic hit. And then when the pandemic really clamped down in March of 2020 is when I really started in earnest. So this was my great pandemic therapy, was to go for walks. So every weekend I had to do, you know, one, two, sometimes three walks. And then sometimes had to go back and do it again just to make sure I got the write-up right. So I spent a lot of my weekends, because I still had a day job, so I spent a lot of weekends on the walking section as the group began to whittle down what the walks might be. And then I would also spend the evenings and weekends as well reading the introductory chapters. Yeah. Well, I should also add, after all the writing and I sent it off, I got the edits back, which was great. And never having been edited quite this way before, it was great to have good editors and see that they can make you sound even better than you, and you still sound like you, which was wonderful. But then we started the process of choosing the 300 photographs, and these are color photographs, which I'm so happy that Timber Press was using full color photographs. And so I was recommending photographers to use. So I was sourcing for photographs and then talking with them and connecting them with Timber Press. So there's some really special photography in the book, because there's some really great nature photographers who live in and around Philly. I was really lucky.
You can tell so much research went into this. During your research, was there anything that surprised you that you had known about the region before?
Oh, so much. I knew some of the vague outlines of the geology, but not too much. That was a lot of new information for me. But some of my favorite new things to learn, the beaver story is really remarkable, because the beaver was one of the first mammals that colonial Europeans extirpated from wild Philly. So they were in the state of Pennsylvania for a longer time, but not in southeastern Pennsylvania, because they were so coveted for the fur trade, being sent to Europe for making those fancy gentleman hats. Right, the felting was made from beaver pelts. So and the Lenape learned that they could trade in beaver pelts for rifles, for pots and pans, for blankets, for other things, clothing. So they began this extensive trade with European settlers, with using beaver skins as sort of their currency. So beaver became scarce in wild Philly, amazingly, in the late 1600s. So by 1700, beavers are in west and north of Philadelphia. And then we kept pushing them back as the fur trade kept going. But what's amazing, the beaver has decided to return itself. There was no campaign to save the beaver. There was no campaign to reintroduce beavers. They just began reestablishing in other places. They likely... you know, they didn't send us a memo, but they likely came down the Delaware River, began setting up establishments along the Delaware, and some of the creeks like the Pennypack that come in from the Delaware came up the Schuylkill, and now they've been going up the Wissahickon, down Overbrook. So they've essentially been recolonizing wild Philly. So there's this great organization, the Roxborough Manayunk Conservancy, which did a tree planting along the Schuylkill on the Manayunk side, probably 4 or 5 years ago already, having no idea there were beavers there. And then when we came back to make sure how the plants were doing, they were all chewed. All the young trees that they had planted were all chewed out. The beavers said, "Thank you very much. We really appreciate the salad bar you gave us." So now they have to put steel cages around the trees that they plant. So we have a surprising number of beaver in Wild Philly, and there's a surprising number of walks, 4 or 5, where you bump into either them, if you're lucky enough, or their lodges, or what you really see are beaver chewed trees and branches. That's really easy to see in lots of places. So that's one big surprise. Another is the Lenape story. And this has been scholarship that's been only unfolding in the last few years, a lot of it coming out of Penn State, where it turns out that the Lenape had been actively managing Penn's woods, Pennsylvania, for hundreds, if not thousands of years before the first European settlers began coming in. And so it wasn't, Wild Philly wasn't as wild as we picture in our minds when we go back to like the 1600s and William Penn arriving here. So the Lenape practice, an aggressive form of fire ecology, they selected areas, would burn it out, and the plants would grow back, and they would set the clock of succession back. And one of the things that they were doing was trying to keep nut trees around, oaks and hickories, and beech nuts, because those nuts provide great food for them, especially acorns. So many Native American tribes across North America relied on the oak and the acorn for so many uses. But what's really cool is acorns attract the animals that they want: bear, deer, turkey, so game food. So they would keep deer closer to them by making sure they had oak trees closer to them. So the landscape was far more managed than we ever gave them credit for. They did live differently and had a lighter touch on the land, but they weren't passive. They were actively managing the landscape. Those are two of the big surprises for me in writing the book.
I think that was the section of the book when I was reading about the Lenape that I was completely stunned, where I was like, they were doing smart forest management practices hundreds of years before people really started understanding how important those sort of practices are.
That's exactly right. So they had an intuitive sense because they've been living here for thousands of years. They had a sense of how, if you do A, then B is going to happen. I mentioned some of the reasons why they did it, but they were even doing it for tick management. Keeps tick populations down. And also, you can walk through the forest differently after it's been burned. So you want to clear out areas so you can travel through them. So there are a number of reasons to do the fire ecology, but yeah, it's great.
What more can you tell us about the Lenape and their effects of the land?
Another big piece of the Lenape story that I think that we don't realize is that it's unclear if any European settlers really saw the Lenape as they really were, because by the time even the first, the Swedish settlers were the first ones to come up before even William Penn and establish outposts in Lenape Hoking, their name for the Delaware River watershed. By then, there had been the presence of other Europeans and other places in North America. And so as the Indians traded with each other, they were also trading smallpox. So smallpox and other diseases were following Lenape trade routes, so that the Lenape populations were already being devastated even as William Penn was showing up. So I think that we never got a full understanding of how a robust, healthy Lenape landscape might have looked back in the day, because they were already succumbing to those diseases, sadly enough. So that's another big piece of the Lenape story. Not a happy one, but an important one to understand. Oh, one of my favorite anecdotes is, we also don't give Native Americans credit for a sense of humor. They're always stuck in so many of our movies, but they're people. So Miquon is the name of a small village near Conshohocken, now been sort of subsumed into Conshohocken Township. There is kind of a Miquon area. Miquon School is there. So it's between Manayunk and Conshohocken on the Schuylkill River. Miquon is the Lenape word for feather. And it was the nickname that Lenape had for William Penn. They called him Miquon, because he signed all of his treaties with a feather pen, with a quill pen. So they say, Miquon, here comes feather. He's got that feather he's going to sign everything with. So it was kind of their inside joke with each other of William Penn's name. And I actually there's a sidebar in the book of Lenape place names, because they have bequeathed to us a lot of great place names. Manayunk itself, for example, the place where we drink. And everybody likes that one because it's Manayunk is, of course, the place where we'll go drinking, right? But actually, that was their name for the Schuylkill River. They called it Manayunk. That's the place where we drink. But that name got given over. So Conshohocken, Moyamensing, there's just so many great Lenape names across Lenape Hoking. And so we've kept the place names, and some of the names are the translations are really funny. So I'd love for people to read it just to get to the place names. It's a great sidebar.
I always find that as a mark of a good book, is it takes me twice as long to read it than I expected, because I'm like, wait a second, when did they do this? I'm like, oh, that's where the name of the Audubon Society came from. Oh, what is this? Lenape. I was like, all right, I got to read some more about that. I was just, the first chapter or the first section of it, I was just enthralled of just learning as much as possible, because I was like, it's one of those things where you go, shouldn't I know this already? Like, shouldn't I have been taught this along the way? It's just like so fascinating. I've really enjoyed that.
Thank you. Yeah. You mentioned Audubon. And we're talking about surprises. Philadelphia's history with natural history is really extraordinary. Audubon, came to the New World here, lived in Audubon, Pennsylvania, of course. So his homestead is here. When Lewis and Clark were sent by Thomas Jefferson out west to explore the Louisiana Purchase, though the two of them agreed that they had to go to one place in the New World to figure out what they should do, because they were going to explore the area on behalf of Jefferson, who was a scientist and a naturalist himself. And so they came to Philadelphia. We were the Athens of the New World back in that day. We were the hotbed of science. So the Academy of Natural Sciences is one of the first scientific academies in America. Ben Franklin, of course, is doing his experiments here. Audubon, we mentioned. The Bartrams family not only has a garden, which is still active today, but they were the king's botanists. They're exploring New World botany and making incredible discoveries, including a tree they named for Ben Franklin, the Franklinia tree, which then disappears in the wild after they discover it. So you want to go to Bartram's garden and see the Franklinia tree. We can't see it in the wild. It's like it's a huge mystery. So there's just this wonder. Oh, the painters.
That was great. I really enjoyed that too. Just learning about these people that were so incredibly good at what they did of these paintings of these birds. And then you're like, oh, I wonder where they're from.
But Charles Wilson Peale and his whole family. So Peale is painting portraits of the founding fathers. He was a huge portrait artist and revolutionary in Philadelphia. But he also establishes a museum called the Philadelphia Museum on the second floor of Independence Hall, for gosh sakes, which it wasn't called that back then, but it's on the second floor of that building. He has a science museum where he and his family, his kids, are collecting and displaying artifacts, and they stuff birds and put them in boxes with glass fronts and paint the habitat behind them. They invent the diorama. So the museum diorama, now classic, we see that everywhere, was invented in Philadelphia by Charles Wilson Peale, a portrait artist, and his family. So we just have these great natural history connections all across the city, and it was lovely to sort of get that all in one bite.
Something else you talk about in the first section is threats to wild Philly.
Yeah.
What threat do you see to Philadelphia's nature, and are they being addressed?
Yeah. And I decided to focus on a few of them, not all of them. But as you can imagine, climate change is a huge threat right now. We're only beginning to address it. So I do have some information, some data on what's happening with Philadelphia, with climate change in terms of, basically the cliff notes are that Philadelphia is getting hotter, wetter, and weirder. So yes, Philly is heating up. There are more 90 and 100 degree days now than there were 10, 20 years ago. So, you know, there's this thing called the 100 year storm, where each year there's a 1% chance of a 100 year storm occurring. So in a century, you should only see one of them. I've seen five or six in my 40 years in Philadelphia. That shouldn't be the case. So we're getting more large storms. So Philadelphia is getting wetter. And then I've seen two derechos come through town. A derecho is kind of a sideways tornado in a way. It's this incredible, it's from the Spanish word for straight line. So it's this incredibly intense front that makes a straight line. And one 3 years ago came from Reading all the way down to the Jersey Shore and came right through the center of Philadelphia. Big, fierce storm, very fast winds. So, and I was then working at this Google Center, and it took out a grove of pine trees. That's one of the most beloved places on this Google Center's property. Pine trees planted 40 years ago. So, you know, climate change teaches us new words like derecho. We didn't have to worry about derechos 30, 40 years ago. So we do talk about that threat, and there's a large number of things. There's actually a section after that of 25 things you can do to help nature. And then the last chapter after that is how you can become a citizen scientist and help collect data that informs things like climate change. So you can collect rainfall. You can install a rainfall gauge in your yard and contribute rainfall data to this huge international effort. But backing up, climate change is one of the threats. Deer, unfortunately, overbrowsing from deer is a huge problem in Philadelphia, especially in the suburbs. Invasive non-native species. There's so many non-native species in the area now. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of things. So yeah, so those are some of the big threats. Stormwater. With the large amount of rainfall falling, stormwater then is scouring our streams. So streams now, when you walk along the stream, they look eroded and they have like cliff sides. And all that sediment has been washed downhill. So fiercer streams are eroding stream sides. So there's a lot of issues. I focused on those few and do talk about. And there are lots of people and lots of organizations working hard to address all these issues. The question is whether we're addressing them at the speed with which they're happening. That's our ongoing concern always.
You included 101 species that can be found in the Philadelphia region. Do you see this section being used as a field guide in the woods or a learning tool before you get to the woods?
You know, it's funny. The book is so beautiful, but I hope it gets mucked up as people take it outside. You know, bend it, dog ear it, get it full of mud as you take it, especially the maps that are in it. So there's maps to each of the 29 walks. So for the 101 species, we decided to select creatures that people, as they go on these walks, are likely to bump into and also have interesting stories. So, for example, the painted turtle is there, as is the box turtle. Now, the painted turtle, you're very likely to see, the box turtle far less so, but we thought both stories were really important, so we included both turtles. But, you know, we had a fierce debate as to how many insects we should have. What's the right number of insects in 101? And writes the right number of birds and the right number of trees. So what I'm hoping is people will essentially read the biographies as they feel like it, as they're inspired to read it. You can read it straight through or just nibble here and there. And then after each species, it tells you where you can find it if you're interested in it. So if you want to see, for example, the American sycamore, just a beautiful tree, with one of the widest trunks of any tree in Wild Philly, it'll tell you where the best places are to see sycamore trees. So yeah, so hopefully they'll use it that way. So yes, take it along, but more likely read about it. And then maybe when you read something, you want to see it and the walk will take you there.
How surprised are people to find out about Philly's flora and fauna? Just the sheer amount that's available to them.
So I think there's a number of surprises here too. One of them is that cities have been established long enough that nature is kind of folding itself back into cities, and nature is acclimating itself to cities. So raccoons, of course, have been a problem in Philadelphia. So within the city itself, with a lot of abandoned houses and trash in the streets, scavengers like raccoons are doing pretty well. So you've got that issue. Coyotes can be seen walking down city streets. Not a lot, but it happens, and it's not as rare as you think. They're pretty reclusive, so you're not going to see them too often, but it happens. Peregrine falcons are the fastest animal on the planet. They can dive at 200 miles per hour. They nest in a church steeple in Manayunk, and one of the walks takes you to the church steeple. If you do it on the right weekend, you can hang out with all the bird watchers at Couch Tomato Pizza in Manayunk, get a pizza and a beer, and they'll let you use their spotting scopes, and you can see the babies learning how to fly from the steeple in Manayunk. But peregrines also nest on City Hall in that tower, and on all the bridges that cross the Delaware into Jersey. So we've got peregrine falcons, once an endangered species, nesting in the area. Bald eagle has a big nest on a pine tree, Tinicum, just a stone's throw from the airport. So, you know, it's really surprising the kinds of nature you can find in and around the city, not to mention the kinds of nature you can find in some of the big, you know, parks, Ridley Creek State Park, John Hines National Wildlife Refuge, Pennypack Park up in the Northeast. Oh my gosh, the whole Wissahickon Valley Park, just, you know, incredible amounts of nature, great bird watching across that whole area. So in the city itself, there's much more nature than you expect. And then in the suburbs, it only gets better.
You spoke about developing a naturalist advisory team for input for the sections on species and field trips. What kind of backgrounds do they have? How do they help you?
So actually, some of the walks I hadn't yet been on myself until it was recommended. So there's a great walk, Palmyra Cove, where on the Jersey side from near the town of Palmyra. And you can walk along essentially the shore of Delaware, and the Delaware River, and if you time it right, you should go at low tide. And I think Philadelphians forget that the Delaware River is tidal, that it goes up and down. So if you go at low tide, you know, you just get this great scene. I walked out onto the beach, and there were three deer, essentially with their, you know, a couple of inches deep in the water. So there were deer. I've never seen deer do that, like wading into the river, and they were drinking. Which was great. On that same walk, I saw a painted turtle laying its eggs in the sand above the water. So it's, you know, I didn't know about Palmyra Cove. And there's beaver lodges there too that are incredibly easy to spot. So one of the eight recommended Palmyra Cove as a site, and it turns out it's perfect. Great walk on the Jersey side, and you get to see you get to see tidal Delaware River, great birds flying around, and things, you know, weird things like deer wading. So they were adding those kinds of walks to it. So they've all been to interesting places. They also know about their own sites and some of their sites I wanted to be included. So they would help me in writing the sections about their sites. They were just, you know, just great information. Many of them have been naturalists for 10, 20, 30 years. So they just had an incredible wealth of information, which I was grateful for.
If you had to recommend one field trip, what would it be?
What a great question. And so hard. So one of the things that I did in Wild Philly, which wasn't done in Wild LA, was I divided the walks into seasons. So I think because Philadelphia has more seasonality than LA does. So you shouldn't just go to John Hines National Wildlife Refuge in general. You can go any weekend, but you should go in early May when the migrating warblers are coming through, right? You should go to Bowman's Hill Wildflower Preserve in late April when the wildflowers are at their peak. So essentially, the best walk is the next one in the book at the time of year you're asking that question. So, you know, in the summer, in the fall, in the winter, you know, winter is a great time to see the geology of the Wissahickon because the leaves have fallen off the trees and you can see the rocks really far away. In the summer, there's a wonderful butterfly meadow in the Andorra section of Wissahickon Valley Park. So you want to go see a butterfly meadow and see the butterflies flying around. So, you know, each, you want good fall color. Two walks, one at Pennypack Park, the other at Pennypack Ecological Restoration Trust. So both along the Pennypack Creek will give you the great fall color. Ridley Creek State Park, I know you're a big fan of state parks. Ridley Creek State Park is just a stunningly beautiful stream flowing through a gorgeous forest with some great history there too. Valley Forge is amazing. So yeah, so the answer to the question is it depends on when you're asking. The answer will change depending on the calendar.
Was one section more difficult to write than the others for you?
Yeah, the geology, because I didn't know it so well, and the Lenape, because I needed to get that exactly right. And, you know, our relationship with Lenape has been so distressed over so many centuries now that I didn't want to, you know, cause any more harm. I wanted to get the story right, be sensitive to the Lenape people, but also, you know, present the new scholarship that's unfolding in a way that was respectful and accurate. So I felt like there was a bit of a tightrope to walk, and I'm hoping that I got that right. And having invented by a professor from Temple University who's a member of the Lenape Nation I was really grateful for that.
Do you think Philly's natural beauty is undervalued or underappreciated by the outdoors community?
I think in the city itself, I think it's undervalued by the people who don't live in the city. So I think that the people who live in suburban Philadelphia should get into the city more often and explore the city's nature, and vice versa. I think that people who live in the city should get out into the suburban areas. So if you live in Fishtown, Kensington, you need to go see Ridley Creek State Park. If you live in Malvern, you want to walk the Wissahickon. So I think that, and you know, if you're a listener to your podcast anywhere in the state, oh my gosh, there's so many great places to see in and around Philadelphia that, yeah, all your listeners should come explore the wonderful nature in Philadelphia. So I think nature is undervalued everywhere that it is. yes, I think that we undervalue it.
What do you hope readers will get from your book?
I think that they will get a better understanding of how rich nature is. They will add more layers of complexity to their understanding of the story. I think that I'm hoping that it inspires them to walk more. Walking, of course, has incredible health benefits to all of us. So just being in green is restful. Smelling pine scent, it calms your heart. Your blood rate lowers when you smell pine. Can you believe that? So it has great, you know, our emotions are better. So I think, especially in the pandemic, it was great to be surrounded by so much green. But I think for all your listeners, you know, getting out into nature, no matter where you are, has incredible health impacts. I will say it this way. You will live longer if you do more walks in green spaces. You will honestly live longer. So go for it.
And as somebody who read the entire book and has that thing absolutely covered in pen marks and dog-eared, I'm so excited to be able to use it. I mean, it is such a beautifully well-constructed book. The color photos, the glossy pages, the illustrations are beautiful. Every little detail is taken care of. As a customer, as somebody who bought your book and read it and plans to read it a lot more for many more years, I absolutely loved it. I think you did a phenomenal job.
Oh, Christian, that means a lot. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, Christian. Thank you.
As a former journalist, I have to know, after doing so much work, what was it like when you got that final version of the book, when you got your copy?
Oh, my God. It came around Christmas. Can you imagine a better Christmas present than that? And I actually got five copies, and I didn't tell my family. So at the holiday, I gave my wife, my two daughters, their inscribed versions of it. It was so special. And Timber Press did such a wonderful job making the book look so pretty. So it's just, I'm so happy. It even feels, the paper even feels good in your hand. And it's, you know, it just, it was an amazing feeling. Thank you.
Well, brings us to the last question, the important question. Where can people buy this wonderful book?
Go to your local bookstore and they will order it for you. I love supporting local bookstores. I love supporting local businesses. There's even a website, independentbookstores.com, and they'll send it to you. But of course, you can get it online anywhere. So online, anywhere books are sold, at a bookstore, hopefully near you. There are some bookstores in the city, in Philadelphia, that carry it. One of my, when I went to Amazon to check on how the book sales were doing, and early on, it was number one in new Philadelphia travel books for a couple of months. That was so excited. And then I went down below and said, people who buy this also buy. And I thought, okay, what book do we also buy when you buy this one? This is the funniest thing. This happened to multiple people. People who buy Wild Philly also buy Bear Low Dose Aspirin. The listeners, try that. But I guess, what are we, all older people who have heart conditions who are going for walks? I don't know.
Just sore muscles.
Sore muscles. That's the funniest thing.
Well, Mike, like I said, I enjoyed this book so much. Thanks so much for being able to talk to us today. I really appreciate it.
Christian, thanks for having me. I really appreciate your podcast, and thanks for the great questions. Thank you.
I want to thank my guest, Mike Weilbacher, for joining the podcast. Be sure to visit our website and follow us on Instagram and Facebook for more information about upcoming episodes. This has been Hemlocks to Hellbenders. I'll see you out there. Hosting, production, and editing by Christian Alexanderson. Music by John Sauer. Graphics by Uncle Traveling Matt's Random Expedition.